Welcome to Venturi's Voice. I'm your host, Ben. Join me as I chat with big thinkers, leaders, and decision makers in the world of tech. We talk about developments and big movements in the tech industry, along with stories, anecdotes, and advice for your own career. If you like the show and would like to hear more from us, you can follow us via SoundCloud, iTunes, or Spotify, or join us on Slack. Welcome to the show, guys. Today we have Chris Bolin, who is Vice President of Engineering at Formidable. Is that how you pronounce Formidable? Sorry.
Yes, indeed. There would be two pronunciations, Formidable or Formidable. But totally happy with either.
Or the French, which is Formidable, I believe.
Yeah, and that is definitely the least popular of the pronunciations.
I think, in a nutshell, could you give us a bit of insight into the service that you provide there?
Yeah, absolutely. So Formidable is simply a group of engineers and designers that do work for other people, right? We're just a consultancy, but we have a couple specific niches in the technology space, specifically web technology, and even more specifically, it's really the JavaScript ecosystem with a center on React on the front end, React Native on the native side, of course, Node on the back end, and then we do a bit of work with GraphQL as a communications layer there. And our cloud service offering is growing a bit too. And we do have a growing design team. But we focus on that niche. And so I guess there are a variety of ways you could structure a professional services company. Some folks have agencies, right, which say, you let us know what you'd like to do and we'll put in a bid for it. And in 6 months, we will deliver you that product. We don't quite work like that. We're a consultancy, so we join with our clients and help them become better engineers as we become better engineers and focus, again, on these like niche technologies that we're working on. So that means that our clients are really broad. We've worked with Fortune 100 companies. We've worked with startups. But the commonality is that they decided they wanted experts in React or experts in Node on their product.
Awesome. Could you tell us a bit about your role at Formidable and your personal career journey?
Yeah, sure. So currently I'm on the leadership team. As you mentioned, I'm one of our VPs of engineering. And we're still a small company, under 100 people. And so one of the things I like is that I get to wear a lot of different hats. sometimes I might be doing a lot of hiring. I have direct reports, so I do quite a bit of mentoring. I still try to help out on the technology side when projects come up. And one of the primary ways I would help out is just maybe screen sharing with some of my engineers trying to solve some of these problems. So jump around quite a bit. I built up our Denver office. I'm here in Denver, Colorado, but I started with Formidable working remotely on the East Coast of the United States, and I moved to Denver for personal reasons. I wanted to be close to the mountains, but then I built up that office. So over about 2.5 years, we grew from 1 to 14 people here. In Denver, and I'm trying to help us do that in some other locations as well. So a variety of roles, and that is kind of my personal journey at Formidable, starting as an individual contributor, as an engineer, and then trying to build up a small office, which was one of the most enjoyable experiences of my professional career, and now moving onto a leadership position.
That's great how you say that you still get hands-on with projects, because I've spoken to a lot of technical professionals recently, and a lot of them are managers and in similar positions to yourself, and they say no matter what managerial role they're in, they always feel the need to still get stuck in. Is that the same with you?
Well, it's really interesting. So I think that as far as organizational efficiency, it would probably be best if managers and especially directors on up just never touch the code. Don't mess anything up.
Okay.
When we get distracted, you maybe can't be relied on. But I also think that accepting a little bit of inefficiency and allowing your technical leaders to still be in the work itself was certainly personally gratifying and I think professionally motivating. But it is tough. And I think that this is an interesting, very interesting corner of the economy where people are doing this work, got into software, you know, for many different reasons, but one of the huge commonalities is that people seem to like it. They seem to really want to make software. For example, my brother's an accountant, and I don't know of any accountants getting together on the weekend to write open source accounting spreadsheets. There's like something different about software, something addicting about it. And so therefore, when you move into management, there's like kind of this ache to be close to that work. And there's a tension for sure. And I can't say that I've personally solved that. But I think recognizing the tension and trying to find a way of living with it certainly seems to be the best route for me.
Yeah, that's really, really cool to hear. At Formidable, is there any projects that you've worked on that particularly shines a light on what you do best?
So some of the work that I've been doing over the last couple of years, when I can actually be in the work, is on web performance side, and especially front-end web performance. And I find that really gratifying because it mixes, kind of very arcane knowledge of how web browsers work with some troubleshooting. And also you can tie some numbers to these things, right? You can use user metrics to tie some numbers to page load times or timed interactive or things like that. Mm-hmm. And that means you have a goal that you're shooting for. So those things can be really fun. We've worked with a number of pretty large e-commerce companies to try to improve the overall performance of their sites for their users. With, of course, a special emphasis on mobile web. I've really enjoyed that work. And it's fun to see when, the analysts might come back and say, oh, wow, you've saved us, like $100,000, in lost revenue. We now have people moving, through the cart process or things like that. And it's, this can feel very, this is a very tiny part of the world, but it's still a fun, it's almost a fun game in some ways, right? Yeah. And I think that's where Formidable really shines. I am not the performance expert at Formidable. I think that's one of the joys of working here is that I have people much smarter than me that I can learn from too. And that's really exciting as a leader to still be learning from folks. And those are the projects I've really enjoyed, is working alongside people who are very, very knowledgeable and picking up on their work and trying to push some things forward myself.
Excellent. You mentioned troubleshooting then. I'm just intrigued to see if you're a natural problem solver by nature.
Well, I don't know. That's it sounds a little arrogant to say I'm a natural problem solver. but I do like tinkering, wondering why things don't work. I think I am an experimenter by nature, for sure. Yeah. And so, for example, when I write code, I will like quickly run it a lot just to kind of see where we're going and where we're evolving and how things are working and tinkering with things. And I think troubleshooting is very fascinating because you can use some of that same experimental approaches. Like, for example, bisecting, you're taking a big problem and you're saying, okay, I don't know where it exists, but let me jump into the middle of it. And does it exist before or after this? And great, now the problem is cut in half and I can repeat this. And not every problem can so easily be defeated through bisection, but I think that those things are very, are fun. That's a treasure hunt. And then I'm sure many people can relate to that sense of just wondering how the hell the system is behaving this way. It seems to be betraying your logic, and so then it becomes a mystery to be solved.
I mean, I've asked a lot of the guests who have been on the show recently, because it's pretty hard to avoid, about the pandemic. So we're all facing it right now, and it's affected pretty much every business globally. How has Formidable been affected during this time?
Yeah, I think that, before I even want to answer that, I need to reflect that this is a giant event in our lives, for Absolutely. Sure, and that people are disproportionately affected. There are many, many types of inequalities and privileges in the world. Mm-hmm. I consider myself to be, by no effort of my own, a very privileged individual. And here is just another way I've been privileged. It's Yep. very humbling. Because I know there are people who work in agriculture or food services or housekeeping or movie theaters. All these places have been devastated, and there's people totally jobless. So I feel very privileged to be a software engineer, for one, in which we can easily work from home. We don't need to be in a physical office. And then two, at my company, we've been very fortunate. And I would credit not myself, but other thinkers in diversifying our business. You could think about a professional services business as being a mutual fund, right? You have your bets are distributed across your clients. And how you distribute your clients, how many clients you have, what size, and especially what industries they are in, can change your resilience.
Yep.
This is a very long-winded way of saying that Formidable's pretty diversified, and that diversification has very much paid off in security through this pandemic, that we have weathered this relatively well. Again, I think some of this has, there are different approaches in business from like the United States to maybe the UK to other parts of the world. And in the United States, what we've seen a lot of businesses do is even if they have laid off some employees, they have doubled down on maybe e-commerce or their software infrastructure. And so we, by again, no miraculous planning on our part, just benefit from that, right? That we happen to work in e-commerce, and so that helps us. It's hard for me to even talk through that because I feel very humbled that I was so lucky. I know a lot of people weren't so fortunate.
I was just curious about in terms of the business and building a culture when you're physically separated. It's such a collaborative industry. How do you boost morale and, how do you go about building good engineering culture?
Yeah, I think, again, some of this is dumb luck in that our culture was already distributed in some ways. For example, I think one of the main reasons people come to and stay at Formidable is the culture. And I can speak from the engineer side especially, but that culture is very, very important. And one of the keys to that for us has honestly been Slack, has been our, the jokes and the collaboration and the internal memes and the support.
Yep.
And all the things that happen digitally and over text too. I think those things are interesting because it's also to a degree asynchronous. So this is a really interesting position to be in when you have a global pandemic and you can kind of double down on that existing culture. I think we have, quite honestly, still suffered morale drop because we can't be in offices together. We can't collaborate. We can't go out to a bar after work or something like that. That is hugely impactful. So, and then I don't think there's a replacement for that. I don't think we've been able to, magically swap one thing out in for that loss. But because we have this online culture, I think we've been able to weather the storm pretty well there as far as morale goes. And again, that's a previous investment that just happened to pay off, right? And I don't even know, investment sounds like too much foresight. This is just how we worked. We started in Seattle. We hired a few engineers remotely. We built an office in London and then Denver and then Phoenix. And again, growing a remote staff all along that way. And we just had to collaborate digitally and again, to a degree asynchronously. And so we could lean into that. There's also an interesting thing that happens, at least at my company, and I think a lot of professional services companies could see this happen, is that you kind of have two worlds. You have your two worlds even at work. You have your professional side where you're working with your client and you're very buttoned up and you present really well and you review others' PRs. And then you can kind of kick back and have fun with your team. And because those are in some ways they're totally separate companies, I think it leads to maybe an exaggerated playfulness in our company. And I think that's very, very helpful for helping people feel like they're connected to a thing.
That sounds like you've got a really cool culture going on there. Culture massively varies from company to company, especially in tech. So it's really cool to hear what yours is like. How do you keep the joy of software engineering? How do you inspire people?
That can be tough. Many people got into this because they really like it, but then there are many practical barriers to enjoying software development in an enterprise, right? In a enterprise that is not focused around you learning or you growing or you entertaining yourself. And so I think one of the benefits I've seen at our company is we have a very strong open source presence. And so when people find something interesting, they can open source that and work on that. I think we've seen a lot of people have side projects and share those side projects with others at Formidable to just say, hey, here's what I'm working on. Here's what I'm interested in. Can we riff on this? So I think those things have been really fun. I don't think it's possible for engineers who got into this industry because they really liked coding to be fully fulfilled by simply a 9-to-5. Unless maybe that 9-to-5 is a company that they run and they get to do everything. I think that it's almost like a musician, right? Like if you're a musician and you are a studio musician, that's not going to totally fulfill you as a musician, but you will pay the bills. It's a great way to pay the bills and you'll have fun and you'll get better and you'll be pushed to play new genres. But you probably at home at night are like working on your own thing. You know, you're writing music, you're getting back to your roots. And I think that it has to be the same in software. You have to work on those personal projects or those passion projects if that is what fuels you and got you into this. I won't say that that's the same for everyone, of course, but I think for many people, myself included, I need those things.
I couldn't agree more. That is really well said. And what a great analogy as well, the music and the recording side of things. They're both two very similar kind of things, and they're real passions of people.
Yeah.
And I think that's what it is. People that work in this industry almost live and breathe it, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes that can be unhealthy. And I also want to be careful that I'm not prescriptive, that this can look many different ways to many different people. And some people, they want a good paycheck to provide for their family. And that's awesome. And that means that you don't have to approach software engineering like I do. You can approach it like my brother does accounting. That's fine. I think it's finding whatever approach works for you.
As tech is moving and developing so fast these days, obviously, how does the business keep up with these tech developments?
Yeah, that's really interesting. So I kind of think of, a technical roadmap. So a consultancy, I'll say, is a pretty simple business in a lot of ways, right? Like you only really have two parties. You have your clients and you have your candidates or engineers, right? And you're trying to connect those two people in the most efficient way possible. But it is a little bit simpler than a product company or something. So in this simplified environment, how do we think about keeping up with evolving tech? Well, I think you kind of lean into something I was talking about previously, which is people's passions, and you see what are the emerging trends and passions of your engineers. React, mm-hmm. We got lucky with React because React hit big and we were early in on that through no miraculous planning. It just happened to be that the clients we were working with and the engineers we had at the time were also interested in this technology. And that helps. So you have to think, I think if you get your signals from two different places, from your clients you're talking to, both current and prospective, what tech are they interested in? What are they talking about? And from your engineers that are, working on side projects and saying, oh, this is a pretty cool tech I'm working on. I really want to get into this. And you take those two signals and you think, okay, maybe there's an area for investment here of expertise. Maybe Rust is an area of investment. Or maybe Go, although Go is very established, but maybe that is another area of investment. Or even more niche, something like Reason on the front end could be an area of investment. So I think you take those signals and try to adapt to them. But I think it's also a bet, and you can come up looking better for that or worse.
Yeah, I completely agree. Just out of curiosity, how old is Formidable? How long has it been going for? You might have mentioned this earlier.
Yeah, I think Formidable is now 7.5 years old. Yeah, that sounds about right. Late 2013, I think the company was founded. So,
well, was there a point where there was dramatic scale?
Let's see. So I joined the company in 2016, and we had about 25 employees, and we've more than tripled since then. I actually think that I probably joined at the beginning of the largest growth spurt. And again, I will cop to the fact that a consultancy is a simpler business structurally than other businesses. But if you find good engineers and you find clients that need good engineers, you can grow. And so therefore we have grown pretty organically. We have grown intentionally sometimes and sometimes very organically. For example, I talk about our different offices as being, two different types of offices. There are like common law offices that grew up totally organically, that we had an engineer that moved to a city and they wanted to start an office there, or they wanted to hire people there. It doesn't start as an office. It just starts as one person and then two people, and then you grow from there. And then I would say there are mandated or more intentional offices. And these offices would represent, for example, We're trying to get into Toronto. And so we hired someone that we believe would be a good manager there and a good recruiter there. It's very similar to our approach in London very early on back in 2016 to find someone who was a passionate and gregarious leader and let them build a team. So I think that you take advantage of those things and you come in with different approaches for different places.
On one hand, you have very technically minded people. And then on the other hand, you have a bunch of creative people as well.
Yeah.
Because creative people aren't necessarily technically minded. And tech people aren't necessarily creative in the sense that the creatives are. How do you manage these relationships to get the best out of them?
Well, I think for our particular situation, we've been pretty lucky in that our designers have been very interested in implementation. And our engineers have an interest in design. And so for us specifically, and maybe it's how we've hired, and again, our design team is relatively small right now, is that we haven't, I think we've been excited to learn from each other, quite honestly, right? I have engineers who are experts in animation, and they're really excited to talk to design animators, right? Or people that have thought about like, how should an animation feel? And then I have people who think about, oh, I can't wait to make that animation perform it. And they, you know, those two fit together very, very well and can be very excited working together. We also have a couple, engineer/designers, people that really bridge that gap. And so that's also helpful to us that, you know, really fill that kind of Swiss Army knife position where they're able to jump into a project and simply contribute to React code, or they're able to take a step back and say, how should the designs feel? And what do you want for your component library? So in that way, I haven't noticed too much division there, but it would be interesting, you know, if you put one of our designers on the spot and said, what's it like to be a designer at a predominantly engineering company? They might have a very different story. Maybe it'd be less rosy.
When you're hiring, I don't presume you look for degrees, do you?
No, it's interesting. I was talking with a candidate the other day, and I think we built up a pretty good rapport on our quick 30-minute call, and near the end of it, they said, well, I got to be honest, I'm not formally trained in software, and I just wondered if that would be okay at your company. I just kind of laughed. I said, well, you have a degree in microbiology. That's much closer to the training than many of us have. I think maybe a quarter of our engineers have degrees in computer engineering or computer science. Maybe another half have degrees somewhere in technical fields, but not, you know, specifically computer science. And then a good proportion came totally from outside of that space. Some of our best engineers came from music, and I think that's really interesting too. There might be something to like the structure and creativity, that tension that exists in music that can also exist in software. But yes, we don't look for degrees, although I love to find that. I think I think it adds something very unique to find someone who has training in algorithms and data structures.
That's really interesting that you say that about music, because creating music is really similar, actually, because you are constantly adapting what you have, and you are, as you're writing music, you're solving problems as well. They do go hand in hand, and I've never really thought of that before as well, so that's really interesting. I've got a bit of a curveball question here that I'd like to ask, because...
Let's do it.
Yeah, because you're obviously ahead of the curve in terms of tech, and your fingers are well and truly on the pulse of what's going on. So in your opinion, what would you say the greatest technical advancement of the modern day is?
Well, how far back do we want to look?
Let's just say in the 2000s.
In the 2000s, okay. Well, I think we already had nascent cellular technology, and I can't remember when the Wi-Fi center was really adapted. But like I remember going to a talk by Robert Metcalfe, the founder of Ethernet. And I remember his hubris in talking about how Ethernet ruled the world and would continue to rule the world. And this is long ago, 15 years ago. And I think he was missing it. Yeah, I mean, of course, he helped our industry so much in some ways, but I think he was blind to the next giant wave that we had of decoupling technology from space, from physical space. And I think that that's been very, very... very interesting and very powerful. Yeah, I don't know. That changes how we exist with our devices. I'm really fascinated by the history of computing And for a long time, what we thought would happen was thin clients. We really thought that that's what would make sense. And I think still, if you presented me with this problem, I would think it would be thin clients, right? And it's interesting because, like, as we develop these thin clients and then let those thin clients become mobile, then we decided to make them thick clients. And I find that very fascinating. And I think that that has really changed our world in a lot of ways, right? That yes, we have Wi-Fi, we have wireless data to connect us to those data centers. I don't think anything we have could be possible without networking, without larger data stores to draw from. But the thick clients then became a big part of our lives. And we think about, like, the responsivity that you get from having my cell phone here with, like, an amazing processor. People have talked about this so often, but, like, that has also been a revolution and probably a big change than what we thought it would be. And we had indications of this, of course, with, I think, the microcomputer revolution was the first time we realized, like, oh, wow, maybe it will look different than we thought it would.
I don't know if you've seen it, but there's a clip on YouTube of David Bowie, and he's being interviewed on TV, and someone says to him, I can't remember what the exact conversation is, but David Bowie just says, the internet's going to change the world. Mm. And this was as the internet was just kind of starting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he keeps on going. He says it's going to be the biggest thing you'll ever see. It's going to take over the world. And then, yeah, honestly, the audience is laughing at him, and the interview host is, like, trying not to laugh.
Yeah.
And then we look back on it, and it's just how right he was. It's just crazy.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, how perception changes. It's mad. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think I am a skeptic when it comes to our ability to see too far into the future, because if you look at the history of prediction, you just see a huge variance. You know, some people were so right and some people were so very wrong. And sometimes mm-hmm. the people closest to the thing were the most wrong because they had such good reasons for believing a certain way and were blind to something else. I don't know. I find that fascinating. Yeah. And you look, we all feel a little bit foolish for laughing at people like David Bowie.
And at the same time, there was that artist who drew a picture of what a car would look like in 2020. And it's like some floating car, like some hovercraft or something. And we all took that really seriously.
Yeah. Well, I think the evolution of technology in in the second half of the 20th century is really fascinating, because I think we leaned more into what it is to be human. Like, what it is to be human is to communicate. We're social animals. We're Absolutely. Not flying animals. We don't have, like, some thirst for hovering cars or something, but we did have a thirst for communication, knowledge, language. I think these things are much more core to who we are. And it does make sense that in some ways we all got distracted by that, right? That we didn't work on our hover packs, and we're nowhere closer to the Jetsons than we were in the 50s. But we worked on, I guess, a much more human project.
I've just got a question just to wrap us up. Have you got any advice or take-home comments for people who are listening who would want to get into a similar kind of position that you're in, or say they've just graduated from uni and are not sure what to do?
Yeah, I think I can only speak to my personal experience, of course, but I think that things that have marked my journey are going deep into specific technology. So I would caution people from trying to know everything and spread themselves very thin. Go deep into a thing, and also invest in people. I think that for me has been the compelling and motivating force for a lot of my journey, is try to invest in people and play the long game. Don't try to play the short game. Don't, when you start interviewing, be honest with folks. No matter what side of the interview table you're on, you can find that fit. But invest in people. I think that for me has been really compelling. And it also gives me a deeper investment in my work than simply, scratching that itch of making some software, which is fun, of course. But I think for me, that deeper investment is so much more gratifying.
Yeah, that's really great advice. Is this a career that you always wanted?
It's interesting. Yeah, so I think I was always interested in technology, but for the longest time I was interested in a different type of technology, in mechanical engineering and moving things and engines and cars. And those developed in parallel. I remember in high school, I would I built computers, and I thought that was really fun to build computers and learn about them and stuff. I never really touched the software too much until I had a band and I wanted to make the website for the band. And then I started teaching my teachers how to use HTML and things. But I never thought that that was going to be a career. You know, that was just the thing on the side. And into my first job after university, I was getting closer and closer to software, but I never considered myself a software engineer. I always felt like, oh gosh, like they have all these trainings and, you know, and B-trees, and how would I ever touch algorithms? Like I was always felt like I was on the outside. And it wasn't until I went back to graduate school for mechanical engineering and finally hit me like, no, I'm avoiding my passion here. And I had a wonderful advisor who let me switch tracks and let me move into computational engineering while keeping a lot of my research. And that compassion of that one person probably changed my life and let me shift to something that felt like a much better fit.
Yeah, I think we might have wrapped up everything there that I was looking to talk about today. Yeah, that was really cool. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Of course. Yeah, thank you for hosting, and I appreciate your thoughtful questions.
Thanks for listening to the show. If you've enjoyed it, feel free to give us a follow on SoundCloud, iTunes, or Spotify. See you next time.